I don't have a PowerPoint, so I'm just going to read my six-page text. This is actually part of a chapter in a book that I'm writing. And it's a book on heritage politics and global city making in Hong Kong, Penang, and Singapore. And this is a chapter on migrant labor. Now, in this chapter, I'm concerned with two things. I'm concerned, firstly, with the spatial and disciplinary regimes that have maintained the invisibility of the migrant workers in the three Asian cities. And the three cities are the former British colonial port cities with large Chinese majorities and are aspiring global cities. Now, many scholars have already written about these regimes as a tangle of regulatory exceptions, international legal collusion, and the micro-tactics of discipline and surveillance. My concern here is how these regimes complement the dominant urbanism that underlie global city formation. Rather than to see the migrant worker regimes as an aberration of the dominant urbanism, I see the two as mutually reinforcing. In other words, the regimes are constitutive of global city formation and cannot simply be corrected by public education and regulatory intervention. However, migrant workers are not wholly invisible, at least not in one of the three cities in my study, Hong Kong, where migrant workers are actively involved in civil society activism and democracy marches. Migrant workers are not only spatially visible, but also politically visible in Hong Kong. So conceptually, I've been trying to find something to explain both the invisibility and the visibility across the three cities. So in this regard, I argue that the migrant workers' role in global city formation have been affected by the cultural politics over the discourse of heritage on the one hand, and the architecture of podiums on the other. I'll explain this later. I argue that the corollary of the podium is the pod, P-O-D, deployed in global city making. Dispersed pods are organic disciplinary enclosures rather than artificial prisons that sustain biological rather than social life. So this is contrasted to a lot of work on disciplinary regimes that tend to take the prison as the archetype, the spatial archetype. Like its natural counterpart, when pods are broken, life released from them blossoms, changing the global city and enacting spatial justice. But the pods have to be broken through a cultural spatial life struggle that is responsible for the blossoming in the first place. Let me explain a little bit about podiums, which will be an earlier chapter in the book. Since the 1960s, urban redevelopment has seen the proliferation of the podium and tower form, especially in Hong Kong and Singapore. In the form, street-level space becomes enclosed, stacked, and structured to produce commercial units with clearly delineated and regulated pedestrian pathways. Residential and office towers would often rise from the top of the podium, with the podium roof providing space for events or further commercial users. This way, the vernacular urbanism of spillage into the streets could be disciplined by private-public demarcation and regulation. Podiums are thus spaces of intense surveillance involving a techno-security apparatus. In more recent developments, floor has become a significant dimension in podium and tower urbanization. Podiums are increasingly being connected to each other by covered bridges, articulated walkways that ultimately connect to subway train stations that are themselves increasingly shrouded in podiums. In downtown Singapore and Hong Kong, one could refuse to surface onto the street and be exposed to the elements, and instead, one could choose to wander around town in the controlled climate of podiums. In newer developments, the pedestrian sidewalk disappears altogether, and the streets become the exclusive realm of automobiles, while people are contained within the controlled space of raised island, combining podiums and carefully delineated and managed open space. So that's the podium. Let me explain the pod. If the podium is the key architectural feature of the spatial regime to discipline citizens in their streets, then the pod is the key instrument of the spatial regime adopted by governments and business and household employers to police, control, and discipline migrant labor. The pod has three characteristics similar to the pod in nature. The first characteristic of the pod is that it is an organic enclosure rather than an artificial enclosure such as cages or prison cells. Migrant workers are kept in dormitories and residential dwellings that fit organically into the urban landscape. For example, migrant workers are often housed on-site in heritage shophouses in Georgetown, Penang, where they work as waiters, salespersons, construction workers, and building restorationists. They are visible in everyday spaces when they work in the day, but disappear from the city in the night. And their wanderings confined to specific sites in the city that again are organic spaces that do not stand out from the urban landscape. On the scale of the city, we can see the channeling of migrant worker flows clearly in Singapore because of the state's tight control over land use. since the early 2000s, migrant workers, unless they are domestic maids, have been banned from staying in rented public housing flats because of friction with residents. With over 500,000 low-wage male migrant workers, the problem of housing has become extremely difficult. Dormitories have been moved to the outskirts of the peripheral public housing estates in the west and north of the island. But migrant workers spill over into the public housing estates at night, frequenting commercial establishments for food and drinks, and occupying whatever open space they can find, from grass patches and fields to the void decks under the flats. Again, this has sparked tensions that have seen government-led grassroots initiatives to inculcate spatial discipline in the migrant workers. Attempts have also been made to construct migrant worker commercial centres for dormitories situated in isolated industrial estates. These are often touted as representing care and concern for migrant worker welfare, but their success is limited. For example, in one centre I visited in the western part of the island, workers preferred to make use of an open field for their activities rather than the centre's manicured but policed open spaces after buying food and drinks from the supermarket at the centre. Few shops servicing the workers opened as a result, and the users were mostly locals visiting the food stores at the centre. Yet, for the purposes of keeping the workers out of the housing estates, the centre has worked, since the workers do not wander into the housing estate across from the open field to get their provisions anymore. As in the other Singapore examples which I give in the chapter, their mobility has been curtailed and disciplined, so that their ports, their places of residence and leisure, will be camouflaged in the global city landscape. Let me move on to the second characteristic, which is the port being something that sustains biological life rather than social life. In 2008, I visited a large dormitory housing thousands of Chinese and South Asian migrant workers with a group of students and an officer from an NGO to conduct a study and write a report recommending improvement to worker welfare to a multinational corporation whose facilities the workers were constructing. It's actually the casino, if you want to know. The dormitory was sited on a maximum security island that also housed port and naval facilities. Because of this, the workers were fenced in and were provided with a provision shop, a canteen, basketball courts, a large projection screen to watch news and movies, and even a computer room for getting onto the internet. When it became apparent that what our visit was about, my students and I were surrounded by large groups of workers who made the security officers accompanying us very edgy. The workers had a litany of complaints, from poor bathing facilities, the lack of space to perform religious rituals, bad food rich in carbohydrates but extremely poor in protein, old movies being rerun every night, old computers that do not work, and to this, the dormitory manager counted that the food was appropriate for the workers as they needed more energy for the body than for their mind, and that all basic needs were taken care of, the rest being frills the dormitory was not obliged to provide. And one of the biggest complaints was that the workers couldn't get into town easily because of the distance and the fact that it was a very controlled space. And they didn't want to socialize with each other, their own roommates. They wanted to socialize with friends who were dispersed across the island and to meet up in Little India or Chinatown. Now in Penang, because of frequent police crackdowns on migrant worker public gatherings and the fear of migrant workers absconding into the interior of Malaysia, employers often lock up their workers at night. One South Asian worker I spoke to was Zahir, who because of his ability to speak English, worked as a tour guide at the Peranakan Mansion. The Peranakan Mansion is a beautiful restored heritage building showcasing the hybrid culture of a wealthy Straits Chinese family, Chinese-Malay culture. Considering himself lucky to be working at a mansion where tips and overtime pay supplemented his income, Zahir did not mind the fact that he had to work all weekends and was locked up inside the mansion compound every night. He shared a back room with two other migrant workers, but everyone kept to himself and cooked their own food because they were from different countries. He used to talk through the front gate to his Bangladeshi friends who live in rented shop houses nearby, but his employer found on the surveillance cameras and frowned on it for fear of conspiracies to steal the precious artifacts in the mansion. To cope with the biopolitical discipline of the austere work-eat-sleep rhythm and leveraging on his linguistic ability, Zahir took to learning Arabic and reading the Quran daily. He had become religious and believed that if he worked hard and surrendered his body to God's will, which is to work 7 days, 24 hours basically, God will allow him to return to his village in a few years' time with enough money to get married and buy land to build a house. For Zahir, the accommodation of biopolitical discipline and his internalization of self-discipline takes on a religious dimension, transforming him into a docile body in the service of heritage tourism, which is the manifestation of global city-making urbanism in Georgetown. let me move on to the third characteristic, which is the last one. And this third characteristic is that when the pod, when it is broken, the life release from it blossoms, but the pod itself has to be broken through a life struggle that is responsible for the blossoming. And the life struggle must draw on the life worth of migrant workers, and it must be spatially practiced so that the workers can begin to claim the city as their own meaningful place. This I draw mostly from Hong Kong, because that's the only place that I've seen such breaking through of the pod. In Hong Kong, migrant workers have used carnivals, picnics, concerts, marches, religious meetings, and even shopping to break out the pods. A key resulting difference is that we find migrant workers themselves acting as activists and staff of migrant worker NGOs, while locals play supporting roles. In interviews, the migrant worker activists recounted their struggle to organize associations as beginning with the struggle over space in the 1980s and 1990s. The right to congregate in certain public spaces for leisure, especially female Filipino domestic workers spilling out from church services on Sundays, was something that was gained through hard-earned fights in the 1990s. These days, the workers have effectively overwhelmed key public spaces like Victoria and Kowloon Parks and the Central Financial and Civic District. Laying cardboards on the ground and sometimes propping them up to make short walls, small groups of friends will create temporary homes where they could take off their shoes, play music, share food and drinks, and enjoy the afternoon. Every weekend, thousands of workers would take over the covered linkways, connecting and running through the podiums of skyscrapers in the Central District. And as the covered linkways are under the jurisdiction of different building managements, when security officers chase workers from one linkway, the workers move into another linkway and sometimes into the grey spaces between the podiums, not under any jurisdiction. These spatial cultural practices were hard-won and were the basis for activist organization of the workers. So a lot of the Filipinos began to organize themselves in these spaces, and the NGOs began to form from these spaces. And soon after organizing themselves, the Filipinos helped the Indonesians and other migrant workers, migrant worker groups to organize. This was made possible by the cultural spaces that the migrant workers had come to share in the city. Once they organized their own life works to enact their spatial life struggles to break out the pod, the Filipinos began to investigate the shattered life works of other communities and shared their methodology with would-be activists from the other countries. In June 2010, I attended a conference held by the Asian Migrants Coordinating Body, which was led by Indonesian and Filipino domestic workers. Between presentations and discussions of strategies to further break the pods and to destroy the pods, the audience was treated to a sizzling techno music dance item and unplugged folk song performance and other performances. The building was held in the building annexes of the St. John's Cathedral on a hill just overlooking the Charter Road area occupied by Filipino domestic workers every weekend. The event highlights the differences between the situation in Hong Kong and those in Penang and Singapore. In Penang, such encultured consciousness-raising meetings also take place, organized by church activists, and like the meeting in Hong Kong, would take place within church compounds. But for Hong Kong, the activities within the church compound is an extension of the activities out on the street, so that the indoor meeting does not reflect entrapment within the pod, but an inversion of public culture into a semi-private space for focused discussion for the next step forward in enhancing the private life, the public life of migrant workers in Hong Kong. In Penang, the local NGO activist is only seeking to fill the gap between the migrant workers and the labour department. In Singapore, such consciousness-raising meetings and performances take place in both public and private realms, but like in Penang, they are organised by local activists for migrant workers. At the Hong Kong meeting, there were only two non-migrant workers in the midst of over 100 workers. A Hong Kong academic who has been providing various kinds of support to the activists, and me, an observer amazed at the cultural and political life that the workers and themselves fought hard to achieve over the years so they could claim Hong Kong as their own city too. Thank you.
Very much, Daniel. So let's invite the previous.